And John Knopfel, our other featured poet this evening, is known to many of you, spent quite a number of years of his life living here in St. Louis, and was on the faculty at St. Louis University. He has read at Duff's before. In fact, he read here at Duff's in the first year of the series in 1975, and was about the most established poet to publish in the very first issue of River Styx in 1975. And we're happy that he's still cooking and River Styx is still cooking too. He's the author of so many books of poetry, I really can't keep track, but it's somewhere over a dozen. Most recently, he published a very delightful book of little tales called Dim Tales, which literally, maybe he'll tell you a little bit about the genesis, but they come out of the bottom of a trunk at a junk sale, so to speak. When I think of John's work, I think of this region. I think he's really a poet of the Midwest, which is kind of a cliche, but in his case, I think it's really true because he covers sort of the nooks and crannies and obscure places and significant but hidden markers, the neighborhood bar conversations, the rhythms of small farm communities, local folklores and fables, and even digging into the roots to some of the lore and language and views of life and nature of Native American peoples in this region. So he stirs up some of the earth, digs at some of the roots. Opens us up to some of the ghosts and spirits. Please open yourself up to the poetry and prose of John Knopfel.
I want to do a few poems for River Styx and then wander around in a long thing called Four Corners and the Little White Pea. It's about gambling, and it's they're not Midwest, they're Southwest. And then if we have time, I want to read you a couple of dim tales. And I should say about age, the other day a young girl got up and gave me her seat on the bus. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. This is poem sort of riding around in Amtrak a lot of this. This is called Lounge Car. I gave her the glass. I'm a can person myself. She bottomed up and asked me, was I prejudiced? Hell, I didn't know. This is one called Naming the Trees, and it's from San Antonio. The girl with the typewriter is Hispanic. I wanted to know what were the evergreens called, the ones between the church and the rectory. She was managing a typewriter for communities organized for public service. Thought about my question, then brightened. They must be Christmas trees. She thought about this some more. Yes, Texas Christmas trees. They are very dry. I let it go. I have no idea what is the Spanish for tee-heeing. And anyway, she had this lovely smile, would make a man want to live 30 years longer. This is called Spring Tokens. Dogwood, its repetitive debate with April, fragmentary winds breathing from the gulf, the yearly assembly, lovers once again triumphant with their begging bowls, earrings hanging from a grin. The lonely woman reads a small poem by Liu Yuxi, a heart breaks a stone. This is pretty much a set of four voices that I heard on Amtrak going to Arkansas. It's called Voices at Breakfast. Oshkosh was full of those damn mosquitoes. In St. Louis, it rained all week in St. Louis. The heat is peculiar to itself there. My God, San Diego polluted my lungs. I didn't know what to make of New Mexico. It was the air. The air was so clear. My lungs were crying with peace and joy. I'll tell you this. When she sold her house to Afros, everybody just hated her. Thought she should have jumped up the price at least. So much hate, I couldn't believe it. Well, a little Social Security and nothing for 20 years with the company. I can't afford to retire. Look at those egrets, the grace, the incandescence. Every time I go to Arkansas, my mother-in-law serves me grits. She knows I hate grits. This one is called Poem Adrift in a Prairie Autumn. Why are you following me? The mornings are cold, the distances covered with frost. This memorable year is folding its parasol. Even philosophers are shaking hands in the bittersweet meadows. I sing a blue song for a blue man. The prisoner is drinking from the tears of Christ. I don't know whether he dances in his cell. And this is an old poem I like to write about angels. This is another angel poem. And it seems strangely appropriate. Within the last several weeks, I added four lines. So it's in, let's see what it is. It's in three parts. I have seen the eastern eye of the archangel. He will have justice and strike this hour's malice backwards into the pit. If he can tell himself today or tomorrow what is right and what is not right. He is sitting there gazing at something on the ground which he perhaps does not see. This exhausted spirit dressed in the linen trappings of death. This veteran of the dirty wars. He does not care about my space. It makes no difference to him, my crooked lines or narrow, or what I am thinking about eternity. He says, your ancestors were no more mistaken than you are. If you are hungry, you will find ashes. If you cut off your fingers, you will cry out. Behind him, the larger elements turn slowly, ominous in their power. I ask my angel, how shall I pray? My angel says, who are you? Now this one will wander around in. If I can't get out of it, I'll just quit. You know, the Iroquois storytellers, their object is to so release the audience that the audience falls asleep. So every once in a while, the storyteller will say, hey, and you're supposed to say, ho! Are you ready for this? Hey!
Ho!
Hey!
Ho!
Okay. Now, when you don't say ho anymore, then the storyteller has done his job. So if you find these totally boring, you'll see it's the Iroquois in me. Okay, we'll just go with these. They're short, and they're one to a page, so you'll know when I'm going from one to another. Four corners and the little white pea. And fingers of rain, clay banks gleaming wet in the rain, tufts of bunch grass stiffened as if each were the only one. I remember the sage, the sudden spice in the breathing air, the sweeps and swirls of mountains in shrouds of rain. Well, this is what he told me. I played the nickel slots. Lasted 2 days. The woman behind me, she hit for 3,000, her second try on the dollar. House got it all back, though. Listen, I tell you, America is going down, down. Listen, you wouldn't believe Las Vegas, the lowlife, sneaking up on you, and you'd better keep your hand on your wallet. I complained, but they said, well, anyone's dollar is good for the house. Can you feature a thing like that? And that was the management talking. My God, the lowlife coming in off the streets. I wanted to see America. I tell you, I've seen enough. I'm on my way back to Pittsburgh. Ha, 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 ha. Beautiful Pittsburgh on my way back. Mesquite, greasewood, coyote tracks, and cougar. No place in the heaven except for eagles. Boulders sun-baked in the washes. Country of plain square graves. A green tenacity, the bitter stones. Food is cheap in the casino. They want you to feel comfortable. Waiters chattering, plates heaped and served all hours. But how do you count hours where there are no clocks, all day, all night, the serious gray faces in the serious gray glare of the lights? The dreamers came half waking with their old dreams, and they wanted to call back the hours and the earth again, and they had those dreams, and there were four mountains and four great rivers and ships laden in the fairways, choosing for sirens or home, and that one living death, his mask, a green dazzle of turquoise, his crooked downward fire, and they dreamed on and dreamed on. The young girls come in with their breasts arched, their backs straight, their high behinds. But I'm just telling you a story. They come in with orange juice for a shot of sugar when your knees are beginning to buckle at the tables. When your winnings drop down to the coin release, they bell like cathedrals. This is the logic of false bottoms. They make two cherries erupt like Mount Etna. And here you go, slipping your money in like some kind of voyeur. The small coins muffled as the large, the sound as hollow. Town tin-roofed in the hot breeze whipped from the east, Hope Welding has a battered tin fence and a craftsman's signature on it. This is a fuel stop town, a sheep place in the rim of the west brooding desert. Brick wall town with a depot and a dozen air conditioners, Main Street humming with them, place disastered when the rains come with their guidons and sharp commands. Orchard unexpected and the windmill here, an old prophet howling scriptures at the land. You don't see me wearing a cap often. I have a cap, though, or rather two caps, both made of the same black corduroy, with pie-shaped wedges and mid-top buttons. Hard to find them. I bought these selling from a barrel in Tahoe City. Got two in case I lost one, you see. They were $2 a piece. What do you mean there is nothing here? No language, no depth, no style, no metaphor. This poem is all about two caps, asshole. So here comes Grandma. She has gold in her teeth. She is here for all chances. Brings her own special white plastic bucket, a Jill for the Jack, and her pail of good fortune. Oh, this is a Social Security first of the month good time for Grandma. I was in Virginia City, was last November, and I probably could have beaten the slots, you know. You play them four or five at a time. They are mounted one on top of the other. You put your coins in and pull the handles. Gives you this sense of power, the whirling tumblers, the lights. You would think you were bringing a child to an idol. Stars above heel a bend, those old counselors with their conchas of beaten silver. They say, look up at us. We are your friends. We have always been here. You know that we will never betray you. My hands, the fingertips silvering now with the dust of coins, and there is silver where I touch the spittle at the corners of my mouth, and silver where I eased the long ache in my eyes. Dust from the sealed tombs where kings could not wash the glitter of it away. I tell... Hey!
Hold!
I tell you, when the croupier sends that little white pea rolling off opposite the blurred spin of the wheel, oh man, that is the cyclical thing. That is the one true beauty. But if someone know-it-all tells you the little white pea will land twice in a row on the same number, he got his degree in bullshit somewhere. Let me warn you, it will never, I tell you, never repeat itself. I swear this on the apocalypse. I think those hats were $3 a piece. What is this country? People want it so much. It is hardly the place to shuck bunch grass. These flat hills, this sandstone strata, barren goodnight acres, fenced with triple strand wire, taut along thin metal post, green and chipped with white and charged, it seems, against stray cattle, the shrewd coyote. Country for those who have never existed, the graveyard of the nuclear dead, this sandstone and shale land, woman with a caste mark checking her list of children or ghosts, children or ghosts. Return flight and the mountains, I am nodding over coffee. I have seen under the wing there has been snow in the valleys of Pennsylvania, a chance work by Pollock. We asked this poet we met what he thought about Utah. He said he thought it was lots of rocks. Said he saw this bench, it was in Provo, Utah. It said, where in the hell are you? He went on like that. He wasn't very interesting. He said he met this boy was wearing sneakers. The faces on the sneakers were laughing. They had their tongues hanging out. There was an old woman. She said the boy's shoes. See, she was with the boy. This is what the poet said. You don't want to hear this, do you? She said the boy's shoes were fit to be tied. He told her she had a loose style. Her teeth were clacking. Her hair was falling out. We told him he had diarrhea of the mouth. He said, well, the whole country. So sun burning through the window on the north like a wound, the Virgin alone in her green garment, child of Guadalupe, speaking the forbidden tongue, green-robed royal weave of the Aztec, this princess, she is the one that you have to beat, the one who will not play by your rules, that ancient blood pulsing in her cheekbones, the unwavering eye. This evening, a single planet poised on the horizon, low hills, and I forget the date. The light is an etched gleam in the faint pink where the earth turns the sun down, train clicking steadily north for Salt Lake City. Cabeza, all this hour you have honored my mind. I have been thinking of your sandals, the unkempt hair, and how this country emptied you until, when you placed your hands on someone's maimed arm, that man could say, my arm is whole again. Surely that was a dangerous becoming when the pride of the conquistador went out. Now, alongside an intermittent, the German silver of the Humboldt sinks where the wagons could not cross. The horizon turns an electric black, the lost heaven still gray above it. When John Kennedy was murdered, the casino owners stopped play for 15 minutes out of respect. But the gesture angered the crowds at table. Someone told me this was how it was, but I said, surely everyone went home. They were adventurers, high rollers. They knew how to exploit an advantage, said they were postmodern. She said they were post-toasties. What is within is without, and a lie is neither. They were nothing. This is the last one now. Hey?
Oh!
Moon rising west, an Anasazi shard. Moon smearing lead paint over mesa and arroyo. Moon sketching the plains white and the black ridges of the mountains. On the moon's cold side, three figures in shadow, robes flecked with silver, wear the sharp masks of birds, their hands are narrow claws. They quarried these placers and found nothing. These are their testaments, these slashes in the hills strewn with boulders. Moon in the desert over fathoms of silence, moon with slow figures forming the canyon wall. Moon reading the book of Job, moon circling the wagons. Do we have time for dim? We're going to do some dim, friends. You should know that Dim is a famous Central Illinois maker of proverbs. Maybe you know the man who holds the basket the longest catches the leaf. Or suck an egg today, scramble one tomorrow. Well, that's a Dim proverb. Now, I found a carton of his old stories at a garage sale in Zenobia, Illinois, and reconstituted them, so I'll read one or two of these for you. This is called Dim and the UFO. This is a rather unusual account, but you have to know that in the fall, in September and October, when the farmers are getting the harvest in, they have to hurry, you know, because it might rain and wet the corn and soybeans, and then they'd have to pay to have that all dried out at the elevators. And so they get out in the fields and run their combines all night long. Well, on these murky, warm fall evenings, if you drive the country roads, the air will be full of dust and there will be these strange lights beetling out in the fields. This is the time of year when the state police get hundreds of calls reporting unidentified flying objects. And of course, well, as I have already explained, what people really are seeing is the farmers getting the harvest in. But this is what happened one night when Dim was over on the east bank of Sugar Creek. He was interested in that area because he knew that in the early history of the town, there used to be Indians would come and hunt on the east bank in the fall. Delaware, maybe, or Potawatomi, or even Kickapoo. He didn't know. He was just over there looking around for arrowheads. It was going on evening, and he was out later than he should have been. Well, he was standing in a field entirely by himself when this thing descended from the sky. It was a real UFO, but it wasn't, as Dim reported. Well, now, actually, he didn't report this aloud because it was such a fantastic story that he was afraid no one would believe him. But he did write it down in a notebook that I bought at a garage sale in Zenobia over on Route 104 near Toby. I have mentioned the garage and the journal in another story. That's where I found out about the UFO. Well, this wasn't a saucer. It was not like some B-type television UFO. It looked a little more like the kind of machine we landed on the moon in the 60s. Wasn't that in the late 60s? Yes. Anyway, it landed on these four long legs and stood there kind of peering through the dark. And then the bottom of it opened and a sort of lift came down. And it was crowded with these alien-type creatures, small purple men. They looked, as Dim said, a little like Shriners packed in an elevator at a convention in one of those motels in Decatur. But these small men were not smiling, and Dim was just stunned watching them as they all stepped off the lift in a kind of knot, you know, and each one of them was carrying an object in his hand or claw. The objects looked a little like sausages. But then one of the purple men came forward and annihilated a weed. He didn't make a flash of light or anything. He just aimed the sausage at the weed, and the weed went up in a puff of smoke. Evidently, these aliens thought the weed was standing there aggressively or something. Well, Dim, you know, was at his wit's end, so he said, "How are you doing?" And the leader of the group came up to him. He looked just like the others, but he was the one who came forward, and Dim figured he was the leader. And he said, as if he had a slice of ham clenched between his teeth, "We do very well, and we have a message." And Dim said, "Oh, what is it?" And the leader said, "As we have now sleeted the first leg of our journey from the galaxy Morris Atunia, we will annihilate mankind and all other kind from this planet Earth, and we will abide here for 1,000 years before removing once again to Maratunia." Dim thought about the weed, and he had a terrible vision of all humanity destroyed in the world, and he said, "Oh, but this is not the planet you are seeking. This is Illinois." "The Earth is the next planet over." And the leader and the whole knot of aliens fell back as if Dim had turned one of those sausages on them. Then the leader said, Oh, this is embarrassing. We certainly honk you for having expressed us from being called stupid. Oh, we will go up and find this other planet. Meantime, peace and joy and have a nice day." And they all waved their claws and got on the lift and went up into the UFO and flew off. those aliens never came back. Dim figured that what happened to them was that they had been so foolish believing him without checking their star charts that the authorities in Morris Etunia probably called them home to prevent them from making some horrible space blunder. Well, as I have said before, Dim never did tell anyone about the UFO, but he had the satisfaction of knowing how he had saved all humankind, even all Earthkind, from assured destruction. Still, there was a fly in his ointment. It was the only time in his life that he told a deliberate falsehood, and he felt bad about that. He was never quite easy in himself for having done that. Yeah. Now, I should tell you that in an age where you have to pay about $80 for a book without content, this thing for $7 is a real bargain. Well, I'll read you maybe a thing called The Python Hound. Do you know that Dim had a dog before he had old Sleuth? Sleuth was another one of his dogs. Yes, he went down to Belleville one time, and he met a fellow there who ran a kennel. This fellow sold Dim a pedigreed python hound. Yes, Dim brought it back up with him. It didn't look extraordinary. This fellow explained about these python hounds to Dim. They're German dogs. You know, in Belleville, there are still people who come up to you and say, "Hey, you want a dozen eggs this morgen?" So it was natural this man would have a German dog, and the dog's name was Kurt Hunt. Tim used to call him, you know, good fellow and old boy. He very seldom referred to him as Kurt Hunt. Well, anyway, the kennel owner said these dogs, there were very few of them in the world, are a very special breed. They are just bred to fight pythons. And you see, one of the ways they do this is, when attacked by a python, they can excrete little oily substances in their fur. So as the snake tries to coil around one or another of them, it slips off. This has a side effect. If a python hound gets a flea bite, the oil appears locally where the flea is, and when the dog rolls over, the flea drowns. So they're not bothered by fleas very much. Also, these python hounds have retractable tails because the python likes to sneak up and bite them, grab a hold of their tails, see, and then swallow them. And by a genetic adjustment over the years, this particular breed can retract its tail. Dim made the mistake of coming back to his hometown and going to the pharmacy and telling everybody about this python hound with these characteristics. Well, everybody just guffawed. They thought it was ridiculous, especially considering the dog that Dim brought with him. It was a nondescript dog. It had a sort of mousy kind of a mange-like coat, you know, and its ears looked like, well, you've seen those Long John donuts. And its tail was askew. It was always sort of 20 after 4 instead of 6:30. In fact, people would say, "If you could just stand him on end, Dim, you could use him to open up bottles of wine." They made comments like that. The dog's belly hung down. They'd say, "That dog needs to be jacked up in the middle. Why don't you go to the vet and have a splint put on him?" They would make those kinds of criticisms. And that would have been all right if it had been a short-legged dog like a dachshund, but this dog had long legs and looked like it was sway-backed. Well, of course, there were no pythons around, so how could Dim prove this was a genuine python hound? And with no pythons around, the dog got into a bad habit. It would attack the neighbor's hoses, tear up the garden hoses. And after a while, people started taking their old garden hoses and throwing them over into Dim's yard to look like a Knights of Columbus hall after a spaghetti dinner. So Dim had to keep the dog in the house. But to content it, he went down to a toy store and bought a snake, a huge snake about 20 feet long. It was one of those fuzzy stuffed snakes, and the dog had a wonderful time just horsing around with it. He'd pull the head off every once in a while, and Dim would have to take it up to the square where there were some ladies who made drapes and things like that, and they would sew the head back on for him. So that's the way it was. Everybody was amused, you see. And as long as he didn't tear up their garden hoses, people could tolerate Dim's nondescript dog. And life would have gone on like that. And Dim would have been humiliated and embarrassed because he had been taken in by that kennel owner in Belleville. But the time came one summer night when a Venezuelan circus drove into town. And they pitched their tents up on the ball diamond near the old mine pond. And everybody, well, Dim didn't go. He was a little under the weather. But everybody else was there, watching the trapeze acts and the jugglers and the elephants, and suddenly those Venezuelans began to yell, "Madre mía, caramba, serpiente boa." Some thoughtless attendant had left the latch open on the python's cage, and it had gotten out and immediately went after the mayor. People had mixed reactions about that. Those who had voted for the mayor were appalled, while those who had voted against him, you know, were willing to see how the contest came out. They had an objective attitude. Well, anyway, the mayor, he got away finally, and the snake slithered from the tent out into the dark of the night. Everybody was frightened then because this snake was loose and it would eat up their pets and maybe go after some of the children. And nobody knew where the thing was. There was a hue and cry and lots of wringing of hands, and then somebody said, "Why don't we go down and get Dim's python hound? Maybe that dog can do something." So they all nodded their heads and went and knocked on Dim's door and told him about the loose python. Dim said, "Well, all right, I'll bring him up." But you know that dog didn't want to go out. He was watching some other dogs on television. Dim had to put a leash on him and had to drag the animal because it was cool inside and the show was pretty good. They had to force him into the car. And when they brought him up and he got out, he was just whimpering around, you know, looking just like he always did. Then suddenly he caught the scent of the python, and that dog changed right before their eyes. He became aggressive. His ears went up and his scrawny old tail. He trembled with excitement, sniffed here and sniffed there. And finally he came to a point in front of a culvert under the railroad tracks, and he went in there. I should tell you about this dog, the way he used to bark. He would go, "Woo, woo, 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 woo," like he was always running down. But when he went into that culvert, there were all kinds of fierce barks and howls and growls and yaks, everything you ever heard of. And everybody stood there waiting. It was like the mongoose going into the hole for the cobra, very dangerous. Then all at once, with a terrifying hiss, the python burst out of the culvert and grabbed its own tail and rolled in a hoop as fast as it could back into the tent and into its own cage and pulled the door shut behind it. And a moment later, out pranced Dim's python hound with his ears pricked up and his belly up and his back straight, and he had this glistening black coat shining with tufts of gold, and his tail was up like a deer's scut straight behind him, and he leaped about marking a bush here and a rock there. He marked everything, and everybody applauded because they knew no python was going to slither where that dog had been. Well, Dim felt a lot different about Kurt after that. he didn't feel bad for himself and his dog anymore. And ever after that, people were pretty circumspect when they talked about Dim and his python hound.